Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this very last day of 2008. We started 2008 with remote broadcasts from Dubuque, Iowa, I think the highlight of our year, the day of and the day after the Iowa caucuses, and then cover the campaign day to day, primary to primary. It is still exciting to me to read about this election, which we covered so thoroughly, and we're happy to talk about it again this hour with Nick Summers, a Newsweek reporter who covered the Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and Sarah Palin campaigns. Newsweek did a 7-part series recently, an in-depth look behind the scenes of the campaign, and the reporters, Nick among them, were granted year-long access on the condition that none of their findings appear until after Election Day. Among the findings, President Bill Clinton was in Iowa, in Des Moines, though, the night of those caucuses, with a TV turned on to a football game, fully expecting a victory for his wife, Hillary. When Terry McAuliffe walked into the room looking glum, he never looks glum, of course, so this was rather unusual for McAuliffe. He knew that the Clinton team was losing, and immediately the television went on a news channel rather than the football game. We have a lot of insight to give you during the course of this hour with Nick Summers, and we'll be welcoming phone calls as well for those of you who still want to analyze the election of last year. No, it's still this year, right? Of this year, we certainly welcome your phone calls, what you think were the highlights, the defining moments, and there are so many of them for this long presidential run. Our phone number here is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join this political conversation, and we're very happy to welcome as our guest Nick Summers from Newsweek. Hi, Nick.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Great. Happy New Year's Eve.
Well, thank you. Happy New Year. So was it a long run for you? Were you exhausted? Are you exhausted now at the end of it, or could you keep going?
I'm pretty good now. I'm still going through withdrawal a little bit, but yeah, it was a really, really long year. And we got started in early September, so it was actually more like 15 months.
Okay. I think we're going to need to get you on another phone line. Is it your phone line that's... We can't hear you very well.
Oh, sorry. Let me try to get a little closer to a... Is this any better?
That is so much better.
Great. Okay.
Okay. Sorry about that. Good. Okay. Now we're much better. Sure. But what, you know, I was reading the article and I thought I had enough of this, and then I was reading it word by word yesterday and thinking I still don't have enough of this. Your insights are extraordinary. The deal was that you wouldn't write about the insides here until after the election.
That's right. It's a project that Newsweek does every election going back to 84. They embed a few of us with the frontrunner campaigns. And we tend to get better stuff from the campaign workers and sometimes from the candidates themselves. It's not always like incredibly juicy from day one, but it's more candid. There's less spin to what you hear because these guys know that they don't need to spin you. It's not going to come out until it can't help or hurt them. It's not going to come out until the following November. So, yes, it's a great way to go through the year and sort of be plugged in, but also be detached from the 45-minute news cycle and
right.
Sort of the scandal of the minute.
Mm-hmm. I was so struck because we were in Iowa that night doing our broadcast as well, but it was interesting to me that this story about President Bill Clinton, who was watching a football game the night of the Iowa caucuses, fully expecting, I guess, the Clinton camp that they were going to win that day.
Yeah, it was really shocking because, not that long before January 3rd, the day of the caucuses, the Hillary campaign was just this invincible juggernaut, and it was thought they could do no wrong. They were the best campaign money could buy, but there were all these problems that just came speeding to the surface then. They thought they were going to win. They thought they were going to do just fine. But all along, there had been these big problems. Hillary hadn't spent very much time in Iowa compared to her rivals and just never really made a connection with the state. Mark Penn, their pollster and chief strategist, wasn't 100% forthcoming with some of the less impressive data. A lot of the staffers believed he was hiding the stuff that didn't back up his strategy. And a lot of them were blindsided.
Mm-hmm. It really sounds from your reporting and your colleagues reporting on this that the Clinton campaign staff was rather dysfunctional.
Yes, that's really the best way to put it. I kind of thought about them a little bit like the New York Yankees. You know, each person they had may in fact have been the best position player at what he or she did. But put together, you know, they're not always going to win the World Series. It's in a lot of ways, the Hillary campaign was much, much, much less than the sum of its parts. All of her people were really great individually, but they just didn't work well together. There was intense feuding from department to department, and there were times when it was really just staggering how unprofessional and amateurish these really smart, really accomplished political operatives were acting.
Until the story of after she lost the caucuses, the next day she's on a phone with this conference call and nobody mm-hmm. says anything. What went wrong? Nobody knows.
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, we that night we left Des Moines at midnight. We landed in New Hampshire at 4 a.m. And you know, and she convened this conference call of her top guys not that many hours later. And she opened the floor to suggestions. Where do we go from here? How are we going to win this thing? And there was just silence in the line. And she tried again. And there was silence in the line. And she said, well, this has been great talking to myself, and hung up on everybody. She really won New Hampshire, not quite single-handedly, because she had a great staff in the state, great mostly because they were left alone by the national headquarters, obsessed with Iowa. But Hillary, more or less alone, really just, yeah, you know, sort of won that state by herself through her own independent action.
Oh, that's interesting. And through that moment, too, where she became human, and Axelrod knew that right off the bat, didn't he?
Yeah, that was an odd moment when she teared up in that coffee shop, because it was just another, you know, deadly boring roundtable. It was like 2 hours long with 14 voters in this stifling room, and her staff was very upset. They were really behind schedule, and then, you know, she got a little misty, and you know, all hell broke loose. And nobody knew whether she had just, you know, completely destroyed her candidacy, you know, with a musky moment, or whether this was the thing she'd been searching for her entire political life, this flash of humanity. And Axelrod knew that it was the latter. It was the thing that was going to save her.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, and you suffered, I'm sure, from some of this as well. I have never been able to understand how these people went from primary to primary, 1 hour sleep, if any sleep, mm-hmm. day after day after day after day, Nick. How can anybody do that? How could you do that?
It is really, really exhausting. And, you know, I mean, Hillary paid for it herself. I mean, you know, she's a 60-year-old woman. She put on weight during the campaign, as anybody would do. I mean, certainly all the reporters did. That was what made the transition to Obama. So one of the things that was very stark was because this guy had actually lost weight.
Right.
He hits the gym every morning. One day he visited a gym 3 times in one day, although there were suspicions that some of that was to meet with VP candidates. But, you know, he's the guy who's fanatic about his health. And the fact that he was losing weight while the rest of us were, you know, getting fat and irritable and, you know, with bags under our eyes, staffers and journalists alike, it was interesting perspective on the guy.
Well, how could you not gain weight? You got all these donuts. Oh, donuts. I'd gain 40 pounds, I think.
Well, Obama's secret was, you know, he would go into, you know, a lot of retail campaigning is going into greasy spoons and, you know, the diners. And he would make a show out of eating, you know, a single French fry, and getting that image taken. And then, he might order some food to go, whether it was hamburgers or pancakes, he'd order it all to go. And you know, theoretically, eat them in his motorcade. But I think most people understood that wasn't happening. He's a guy who's very, very, very picky about what he eats. He's very, very abstemious in that way.
Yeah, as you write or somebody writes, who in the world orders pancakes to go?
Yeah, it was said that he likes to order the same dinner of salmon, brown rice, and broccoli whenever he could get it on the road. And he had a certain kind of protein bar that he liked. That was one of the few sort of rang false moments during the campaign was when he was in Pennsylvania and he was having beers. And I can't recall if he actually stopped and got a cheesesteak, but that sort of thing. And that's just not Obama. That was one of the periods where he sort of had to grit his teeth and have the unhealthy stuff.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the early decision. People were wowed by him early on, including members of the Robert Kennedy clan. I was interested that Axelrod is also a Kennedy aficionado, reading Robert Kennedy's writings in his spare time, which was interesting. The decision, how he was approached, who approached him and said, what are you doing in 2008, and the process that he went through to decide that, okay, this is the time.
You're asking about Obama's decision to throw his head in? I think the critical piece of advice is that you run when you're hot, and that in the political factors they only come together in a perfect storm every so often. And that there's a lot of guys who are on Capitol Hill or who have left Washington who are convinced they could have been president if only they had run when they had had an itch to do so in some year and chose not to. Who knows what would have happened? It's amazing how much the Obama message was exactly the same on November 4th, 2008, as it was in the beginning. It was about change. It was about postpartisan unity. The idea that Obama himself, physically embodied change. It was one consistent message all the way through. And I think that the fact that they saw that so early and then were able to stick with it all the way through, they only made one little tweak. That was after wrapping up the nomination. They went from a slogan of change we can believe in to the change we need. Change we can believe in was a very, very, very brilliant, subtle dig at Hillary without mentioning her. It was change that's authentic, because the Clintons are thought to be, calculating, devious.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the rare instances where they didn't quite have their finger right in the pulse of the electorate, they took them a little while after wrapping up the nomination to change from the change we can believe into the change we need, to sort of tie into the urgency that we need to fix this financial crisis. But they were so consistent with what they saw right at the outset that Obama was the change agent for this year. It really, really impressed me.
Yeah. And why is it that in the chilling moment almost at Coretta Scott King's funeral, where Ethel Kennedy talks about the torch being passed to him?
That's right. She leans over and whispers that to him. I think that, Obama just, it's still worthwhile to remind ourselves just how new he is and just how much of a chance a lot of people have decided to take on him early when they saw just a flash of something in him and decided, mm-hmm. this is our guy. And that's certainly with the Kennedys. Teddy, in explaining his endorsement, just said one word, Caroline. And it was very much a, you don't want to assign too much importance to any one thing, but that endorsement sort of contributed to the to Obama, playing to a tie in the press on Super Tuesday, February 5th, and a win in the delegate column. And, you just have to wonder if he would be the nominee without it.
Right. Let's spend a few moments. I certainly don't want to spend a lot on Jeremiah Wright. And Obama saw that Wright might be a problem, I believe, and was once it hit the press, and then asked his staff to come up with all of the things that Wright had said in his sermons, but nobody seemed to be forthcoming on that. He never got that, did he?
Yeah, that was Axelrod said that was one of the areas where their research department didn't come through. That was it's obvious now, and it should have been obvious then, that they needed to get out in front of that time bomb, really,
yeah.
which did go off. It's important to remember that the Obama campaign wasn't perfect. There was a major screw up, and that, along with his bitter comments, were the two things that dogged him the most early. Although I have to say, though, that the way Obama eventually responded to the Wright thing with the speech on race in Philadelphia, his staff pointed to that again and again and again as their personally held evidence that they were working for the most remarkable politician that they had ever seen, or probably that their parents had ever seen. You never want to say that the Reverend Wright thing was a positive, but the way that Obama responded to it did get him sort of did elevate him to the level of I don't know, maybe going from superstar to demigod in the eyes of his staff,
right,
and in the eyes of a lot of the electorate.
It moved many of them, if not all of them, his staff, to tears.
Yes, definitely. And like you mentioned, these guys are working on an hour of sleep a night and eating pizza three meals a day. And I would ask them, how are you guys doing this? And they would, and that was almost to a one. They would select that speech as sort of proof that they weren't working for a regular guy. And as my colleague Darren Briscoe points out, in his reporting for the book, the race speech really was all Obama, mostly because nobody else on the staff had any idea what to do. They were just scared witless.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an example of the candidate himself really, just seizing the campaign
And it was his decision, wasn't it? I believe that they were not wildly in favor of the idea.
Right, yeah, yeah. He wanted to do it. I think he had a confidence that he knew what he wanted to say. He knew he could deliver it soberly. And it turned out that, you know, there's so much second-guessing of strategy in Washington on all the cable networks. And Obama just had this hunch that he could actually have an adult conversation with the American people. And, you know, the speech came off really well. I think it wowed everyone. I mean, it didn't put out that fire, but it mm-hmm. it got it down to a manageable level, kind of like the viral rumors about him that he's a Muslim, he's not a citizen. Those never went away, but they got them down to a manageable level where it wouldn't cripple his candidacy.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Nick. Nick Summers is our guest on this last day of 2008. We're looking at the presidential campaign of 2008. Actually, it was 2007 and 2008, wasn't it? Nick is a Newsweek reporter. He covered the Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and Sarah Palin campaigns. And Newsweek has done a 7-part series, an in-depth look behind the scenes of the campaign. The reporters granted a year-long access with the stipulation that they could not reveal their findings until after the election day, so that this is very rich and deep reporting on what was going on behind the campaign scenes, and it's worth your read. Our phone number, the moments that you remember, he also covered Sarah Palin. We just started with the people who won the election, but there are interesting stories about John McCain as well and Sarah Palin. So feel free to remember your moments, defining moments of the campaign. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our lines are open. Rob Schroeder will be answering your calls and get you on hold. And let's keep talking about politics, huh? At least we're reminiscing now about the year, which was an extraordinary political year, unlike I think any I've ever lived through. So what do you think? Join us. Our phone lines are open. I'm Kathleen Dunn. We'll be back with Nick in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Nick Summers, our guest, Newsweek reporter, and we're talking about the campaign and welcoming your phone calls. Give us a call, would you? We're in a new studio, and we want to make sure that all the lines are working, too. So I don't know where you are this morning. Maybe everybody's getting ready for tonight. But feel free to give us a call and talk about your memories of the campaign. And probably some of you have had a chance to read the Newsweek long series and are interested in some of the insights of the reporters who covered this. Again, our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join our conversation this New Year's Eve, this last day of 2008. Let's spend a little while on John McCain, Nick. Where was the John McCain that everybody loved? He was a maverick and loved the press, Straight Talk Express that we saw in the year 2000, love reporters, et cetera. What happened to him in 2008?
This is really one of the more sad things that happened in this election, was that John McCain that everyone was so enamored of. It's a mystery. You know, where did he go? I didn't spend much time with McCain, or really any time with McCain myself. I got glimpses of his campaign once I started going out with the Palin campaign a little bit. But I remember hearing from my colleague Katie Connolly, who did cover that campaign, just the sort of abrupt, the abrupt stop to the friendly, rolling press conferences on his bus, on his plane, over the summer, when when Steve Schmidt, the strategist, took over the McCain campaign and said, you know, this is not going to work, the press is not your friend. And it's hard to know whether he was right or not. I mean, I think he was right that McCain probably was going to create trouble for himself with his access and with his the sort of slips of the tongue that come when you're talking so many hours on the of the day on record. But it did cost him so much in terms of that question you asked, where did this guy go? And, you know, ultimately elections are a referendum on the personality of the candidate. This is a belief of mine personally. And I think that was incredibly damaging to McCain when voters just sort of realized that I at least like this guy. What happened to him? It's funny that, you know, right after the election, he kind of popped back to his old self and made some funny TV appearances. it was similar to what Bob Dole did after the 96 race when he, I think I recall him going on Letterman or doing a couple of ads for Pepsi and, you know, sort of cracking jokes and people were wondering, well, hey, how come that guy didn't?
Right.
She seems pretty fun.
Yeah. Let's go to phone calls. We have tons of them now. Let's start with Marty from Douglas County. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good morning. I'm wondering what life inside the Palin campaign was like. Was it chaos? Was it constant, here, say this, do this? She was such an ill-equipped candidate. I just picture chaos behind the scenes.
I did have a hunch that the first question was going to be about Palin because everyone's so endlessly fascinated by her, and rightly so. She really is fascinating. Short answer, yes, it was chaotic. The most, structurally, the most important thing to realize about Palin, the pick of Palin, is that when she joined the ticket, she didn't bring anyone from Alaska with her. There's not a political apparatus in Alaska of aides to really understand national politics the way that there are in the bigger states in the contiguous U.S. And so she didn't really bring many of her people with her, and she was dealing with these very new McCain advisors and also guys from the Bush team who joined the campaign, and they had to get her up to speed incredibly quickly. One way she was described to me was as during her speech at the Republican convention. It was Palin as a pilot in a storm. She, there was all this stuff going on about whether she had been a disastrous choice or not, and she brought the plane in for a great landing at that speech. And it wasn't that she loved the chaos, but there was a certain part of her that actually did thrive in it. And in that way, she and McCain were very much alike. They both liked seizing control in moments of disruption. Really, that campaign was not a really well-oiled one.
Mm-hmm.
And they often made decisions on the fly with sort of amateurish ends.
I was watching some cable news last night, and they were doing reflections of the campaign. You've probably seen some of this, too. And I was so struck, Nick, by how much we remember of her due to the comedy sketches that we saw.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's, for someone who, I think of the 2008 campaign as beginning in December 06 and going all the way, through Election Day. And Sarah Palin was only in it from late August through the end. And it is amazing how much of the race, when we recall it, she's a part of.
Right.
There's something about her that is extremely, it's unrefined ore. There's something very valuable there. There's some real talent there. And she, first of all, absolutely will be back. She's very ambitious. And with the right coaching and the right sort of polishing, we're going to continue to see her in many different points in the future. For now, there's still a bit of I think probably a lot of your listeners have seen on YouTube this clip of her doing a Thanksgiving Day press availability.
Yes.
At a turkey farm.
Yeah, I know.
Turkey farm. And this is sort of an example of if you're a governor of any state other than Alaska, I think your staff knows how to set up that shot, how to make sure there's something pleasant in the background,
right,
and not
right.
Say turkeys having their heads lopped off in a big killing machine. I'm exposing myself as a New York media reporter when I don't know if that's the right term for the turkey farm. But it was so comical and so absolutely you can't take your eyes away from it.
Right.
Sort of her personality, and then with just the chaos going on behind her. Anyway.
Right. So did they not talk to each other? The article talks about the fact that maybe once a week they'd have a conversation, McCain and Palin.
Yeah, it wasn't really a great relationship.
No.
I always thought was curious because, the pick of Palin was a Hail Mary pass. And it actually worked, in the beginning. She ended up being a liability, but it worked in the beginning. And then when it started to when the charm started to wear off and it became clear that she was going to be a liability, it sort of seemed like a lot of the guys in the McCain camp were blaming Palin, and that seemed odd to me. If you hurl a pass downfield towards one receiver surrounded by a bunch of defenders, you don't blame the receiver when a Hail Mary doesn't come through. They really didn't see there wasn't a great chemistry when they would appear together. In a lot of ways, it kind of exaggerated McCain's age because she's so youthful and vibrant. And he occasionally, unfortunately, can come across as the age that he is or
right.
older. It was a risky thing to try that worked in the beginning, and then when the wheels started to come off, it wasn't a pleasant place
mm-hmm.
to be.
Thanks, Marty, very much for your call. We go to John from Superior next. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Hi.
See, I wanted to just make an observation. It seemed this was a wacky political year. I would have to agree with that. And I did vote reluctantly for John McCain, but I'm not unhappy that Barack Obama is our president. Having said that, it seems like the media was like a cheerleader for Barack Obama. And I've read a number of stories that back that up with, you know, a number of positive stories toward Barack Obama versus number of negative stories versus John McCain. And I worry that we've lost objective journalism. And I think I was watching the same show you were last night about maybe it was MSNBC recapping the year. And mm-hmm. MSNBC was nothing more than a cheerleader every single night for Barack Obama and dissing John McCain. And I'm thinking, when did this happen? When did media become cheerleaders for either candidate? This is a very troubling trend from my perspective, and I wanted your guest comment.
You're exactly right that it was a factor. I'm remembering now the first misstep for the Hillary campaign was when she was at a debate in Philadelphia. She gave a confusing answer about driver's licenses for illegal immigrants, and she got destroyed for it. And then the next debate, a week or two or three weeks later, Obama made the exact same slip up and just totally skated away with it. The two campaigns, the Hillary campaign and the Obama campaign, were the subject of much different treatment in the press. Some of this stuff, I don't want to use the word justified, but some of it can be explained. I mean, there were more stories about the Obama campaign working well and more stories about the McCain campaign doing poorly, because the Obama campaign was a really well-run shop. They blocked and tackled well. They dotted all the I's. They crossed all the T's. They did the sport of politics very well. And McCain blew up his campaign three times. There was always people going in and out, always changing the message. So to some extent, those stories, they were correct. Looking forward, though, I really think that the honeymoon will be over very quickly. The press, while it may have its favorites from time to time, we're also, too competitive and in too dire straits as an industry to ignore the news or to not seize on whatever inconsistencies or mistakes the Obama administration makes next. And reporting on the campaign is one thing. Reporting in Washington on governance is another. And, reporters are just too competitive with each other to sort of give the president of the United States a pass. I think you're going to see some tough journalism mm-hmm. coming out of covering the White House.
Mm-hmm. And we were talking about MSNBC. They've found their niche as kind of a liberal response to Fox, don't you think? It's not pure journalism anymore. They have become cheerleaders. They're thought of more liberal.
Their biggest hits, Olbermann, mm-hmm. Rachel Maddow came on towards the end of the election. It's hard to know for me what the real impact of cable news is, because the viewership of these networks isn't really so gigantic. A lot of the viewership is within Washington, within New York, and it becomes an echo chamber. And sometimes I think their influence is exaggerated. A newspaper might write about something, and then cable will go berserk over it, and then the newspapers will write about how cable is going berserk over it. And
right.
Obviously media bias, I think was a factor, but it's a very complicated question. When I went over to the Obama campaign, it was so smoothly run in terms of just things happening on time, the plane being ready, the events, there was always power and internet at the events, those little miniature things. That went so well that there was sort of it's pretty boring being out with Obama, and the reporters weren't shouting questions at him. They would get to question him at periodic press availabilities, but I don't want to say he was coddled, because there were some tough questions for him along the way, but there was sort of the fact that this campaign went on so long, and it was a lot of the same reporters from day one until day 2 million, however long it went, that sort of familiarity, I think, probably is something that should be looked at and improved on in the next campaign cycle.
Thanks, John, very much for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. You're listening to the Ideas Network on this last day of 2008, and we are looking at the presidential campaign with Nick Summers, a Newsweek reporter who covered Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and Sarah Palin during the long run. And he is with us. Newsweek did a 7-part series on, with the stipulation that they would have behind-the-scenes access to some things that haven't been reported before. You thought everything had, not everything has, with the stipulation that it would be written about after the campaign, which it has been. And that's what we're talking about. We go next to John from La Crosse. Hi, John.
Hi. What a great idea for you guys to be able to get access like that and do something like that. The way I voted didn't end up mattering in the election. Either way, I try to find myself very much in the middle. I really try to see both sides of the issue and then make a vote. One of the things I was disappointed with was, I think your last caller hit on it, is the media's portrayal of the two, especially Sarah Palin. I had hoped we'd gotten a little farther than bashing in our country with people for humor, but Saturday Night Live seemed to handle that well. But my real question is give me something from the Palin campaign that you say, wow, she did an outstanding job in this, because to be a governor of a state, there's only 50 of those, and to be where she's at, she's obviously not ill-equipped. I think one of your callers earlier put that up there, and I also think that she does have some real skills as far as what she's able to do and how she's able to handle things and her tough life decisions she's made. And I did not vote for her, but I do think I do think that she is a unique individual. And give me something real positive from her campaign, something you go, wow, she did this better than anyone. Can you do that?
It was startling how, when she would walk on stage, and the first glimpse that I personally ever got of her was sort of through a massive waving hands and signs. It was just her hair bun. That was the first part of her that I saw. It was very very iconic. From the moment she comes out on stage, the ability that she has to connect with audiences is extraordinary, and people, a big swath of people, just eat her up. They love her. They love the way that she frames things. One time in Florida, it was a beautiful morning. I want to say in October, she was talking about energy, and she was saying that she's in Florida, and off the coast there's oil deposits and there's solar power, and she was saying God has so blessed you here, and it was a way of bringing religion into the energy debate that I think no one on the Democratic side, and not that many people on the Republican side, would have thought to do, and it seemed so natural from her, and it just clicked. It was a great moment. It is the ability she has is very raw, and it'll be refined over the next years or maybe even decades. She is really great at amping a crowd up, at getting them going. The best political communicators, and I'm thinking of somebody like Bill Clinton here, can conduct a crowd in a lot of different ways. They can slow the tempo down. They can bring it back up. They can make a crowd think. They can make them shout. And she's great at sort of the more energy. And I have every confidence that she can do all those other things. She's probably in Alaska right now learning them. She's gonna get as good as she is. She's gonna get a lot better.
Mm-hmm. But you would have to admit, wouldn't you, that she has a long way to go. And part of the problem was that you could make fun of her because she wasn't up to speed, which I found flabbergasting, on issues that you have to be up to speed on if you're running for vice president of the country.
Yeah, her Katie Couric interview was, I really don't think the importance of that can be overstated.
Right.
Katie asked her what she reads. And one of her aides explained it to me is saying, look, Sarah Palin, she reads. She reads the papers, she reads magazines, she reads books, but she was so uncomfortable in that moment. She had not done her homework. She had not prepared. She froze up thinking, well, if I say the New York Times, am I going to, undercut the McCain campaign's Times, criticism of the Times as an Obama cheerleader? You can sort of see her having an answer in that moment and not saying it. And it's really not so much that she wasn't prepared well. She probably could have been prepared better, but it comes back to her. She wasn't. She thought she could just ace this interview. She wasn't prepared to answer these pretty obvious questions that were coming at her. And one final observation on her from a staffer. He described her as a tabula rasa, and he didn't mean it in a completely negative way. He didn't mean that she was a blank slate. He meant that she was a slate that had not been written on yet,
mm-hmm.
and it was a strong slate. As a real person and as a political talent, this is a person with a lot of potential, but it's just not there yet. And when you're up in Alaska, it's just different from being the governor of, say, New York, or
sure.
even Texas or Illinois, Virginia. It's just you don't spend your days thinking about the same issues that the other governors do, and you don't, you know, you're not as easy as it is to deride the Washington social functions and the Sunday morning talk shows. As easy as it is to deride those things, well, when you do those things, when you have a history, then like that's practice. That's batting practice. And you know, she would have been better to have been to doing a little more of that in the very brief time that she was a governor. And we're going to see more of her. She's going to get a lot better. We're going to see more of Sarah Palin.
Nick Summers, our guest this hour, Newsweek reporter, and we're looking at the 7-part series Newsweek has done, an in-depth look behind the scenes of the campaign. Nick covered Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and Sarah Palin. Our phone number, thanks very much, John, for your call. One line is open at 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Happy holidays from all of us at Wisconsin Public Radio.
We go back to your phone calls now. Paul from La Crosse is our next caller. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning. Yes, I always thought that this campaign, because it went on so long, was a bit like Groundhog Day. And you spent the whole, some of the time you spent saying, what am I going to do to put in my story? I got 500 words I got to get done. And other days you were just sleepwalking. You're going through the motions and kind of, let me just get through this. I'll find something tomorrow and then everything will be okay. But it was this cycle of going up and down and up and down. I was wondering, what did you do during the campaign to stay focused on, this is my job, this is what I'm here for, mm-hmm. and being able to do that every single day?
Well, here I have to give a lot of credit to Newsweek magazine, which we've done this book project every election back to 84. It's the baby of the legendary Peter Goldman, the great writer. It's unique in the political journalism world. Because we take a few, usually young reporters, embed them with the campaigns, and we cut a deal with sources that everything that you tell us, we're going to keep in our notebook secret. We're not even going to share it with our colleagues at the magazine. We're going to keep it secret until after Election Day, when this big 7-part series and then coming up a book will be released. So for me and my colleagues on the book project, we actually weren't writing every day. Getting us some dirty looks from our colleagues in the press who were meeting, daily, if not hourly, blogging deadlines, it really frees you up from being part of the lockstep political journalism commentary establishment. And it lets you see things in a little bit of a different light. And it sort of lets you, tune out the stuff that gets repeated day in, day out, and look for the things that are different. And I have to give a lot of credit to Newsweek for, putting four of us out there away from the magazine, not writing for an entire year with the faith that we were in secret going to come up with a story that was different than the one that everybody else was writing, with previously unreported stuff, and that really gives an insight into the candidates themselves and how the campaigns were a reflection of their personalities, their leadership styles. If people are interested in reading a single long form take on the campaign from start to finish, I would recommend picking up our book. It's out January 12th. It's called A Long Time Coming. It's on Amazon right now.
Thank you very much for the call. Interesting question. Let's go next to Brett from Appleton. Hi, Brett.
Hello.
Hello. Go ahead.
I was wondering if the guest had any insight into the discussion about the investigations into the Bush administration. I know Biden made a more public statement about it. He said there would definitely be investigations of the previous administration, as he put it. And then about a week or 2 weeks later, he absolutely denied having ever said it. And I was wondering if there was any discussion behind the scenes about that topic and if there was any conclusion going forward.
I have to say, I don't have any specific knowledge on that specific question. I know that Biden, you know, he often got in trouble for saying one thing and then needing to walk back later, or even having having Barack Obama have to walk back for him. The larger question of how to run against Bush was, you know, an interesting one from start to finish. I think, again, this is what we were talking about earlier in the hour, just the idea that Obama positioned himself so well as the anti-Bush in almost every way, served him from day one until the very end. But I'm sorry, as your specific query about Biden and the investigations, I'm just not sure. I mean, Obama talked a lot about postpartisan unity. I think that while there's a big thirst for investigations, into some of what the Bush administration did on the part of Democrats or just people who aren't happy with the Bush administration, my guess, and it's just a guess, is that we're probably Obama's probably going to let that stuff lie. It would be as cathartic as it would be to a certain part of the country. It would probably get in the way of Obama accomplishing some of the legislative stuff he wants to get out. We're talking about tax plans and health care and other stuff like that. My guess is that he is going to let that fight slip by. But
he's got a lot to do. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go back for a moment, because I think that these were touching moments as well. We get caught up with personalities in this country, but we were talking about Hillary Clinton's moment of humanity. Obama appears to be a fairly cool, erudite person, for the most part, but there have been times, and you write about them in this piece, when he has become very emotional as well, and it's when he's away from his family.
Yeah, he was certainly much more much happier whenever he was able to spend time with them. The long campaign really did drag on him. Obama. I mean, he's a really fascinating guy. He's, you know, for being so young and having kids as young as he does. There was one. The family came out to Butte, Montana, over the 4th of July holiday. They spent a few nights there, and Malia turned 10 on the 4th of July, and we were flying out of there, and Obama came back to talk on the plane, and he sort of, at the end of this press avail, someone asked him, you know, was Malia couldn't have been too happy with Butte, Montana, on her birthday. She probably wanted to be in Chicago with her friends, and Obama was quiet for a minute, and he said, you know, can I just say that we had a really great time last night. We had, you know, we had the girls over, we had some friends, we had all of Malia, you know, we had the Jonas Brothers on her iPod, and we were dancing, and we had some cake, and it was just, you could see that he actually believed it. It was a nice moment on the plane, just how important family was to him, I remember being struck on that trip how little reporters liked Obama, because there's all this talk about how reporters were just, you know, in love with him and they let him get away with everything.
Right.
Actually, out there on the plane with Obama, most of the guys did not like Obama. He didn't talk to the reporters very much. When he did, he was aloof, and he's a very smart guy, former law professor. He can spar in a Q&A session with the best of them. He would dumb his answers down so as to get in and out of a question with the minimum of fuss and risk. And the reporters, I think, resented that. They wanted to be sparring with the guy. And there's a lot of distaste for him. But as soon as he ever gave a glimpse into the family life or himself as a person, or what he was really thinking or feeling, you know, all that animosity really went away. And it was, I think that moment went both ways. I think reporters were struck just as much by Obama's sort of candid
emotional
moment.
Considering, though, that not really animosity, but that lack of access to him, one of the earlier callers talked about how the press was very kind to him, and I think that's true. Why would that be the case if they weren't granted much access?
Well, the Obama campaign did a masterful job at being pretty opaque. For a couple of different reasons. I mean, one, they never really showed any cracks in the facade of their organization. The reporters can get a toehold in or sort of begin to pry at and get inside. That's sort of cracks that begin appearing in the Hillary campaign or the McCain campaign, and that once reporters sort of see weakness and they go to it and they find out what's going on inside and they can see what the candidate is really like behind closed doors, that never happened with Obama. And they succeeded in putting out only the image that they wanted to put out of the guy, which is very photogenic and very intelligent and all these positive attributes. Second, there was such a groundswell of curiosity about Obama in so many different parts of the country that they got so many magazine covers. Sometimes you would see some pretty unusual people for a campaign plane on the plane, like the editor of Men's Health would appear. wouldn't be going to the speeches, but would just be on the plane because that was where they did a lot of these 30 minutes with the senator interviews. You get 30 minutes with the guy, you can snap a couple of pictures, and if in exchange you put him on your November cover. And these are a lot of the titles for the African American community. It's Men's Health because he is a fitness nut. He was on Rolling Stone multiple times.
He sure was.
Us Weekly, and those covers sold. So in that way, they were able to those magazines got to a lot of people, and by giving those guys a undisturbed half hour with the candidate, they can safely ignore the Daily Reporter for the networks or for a newspaper,
mm-hmm.
And sort of count on the momentum of the 45-minute or 45-second news cycle, carrying forward.
Let's go to Glenn from Eau Claire next. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, good morning. I guess my comment was that I believe where McCain, where we lost the true John McCain, is he had to twist himself into a position to fit the views and the stances on issues that his supporters or his contributors felt, so that he couldn't be the John McCain that everybody come to know over the years. And I guess that's my comment. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Glenn.
This is a very good comment. It makes me think of the VP selection. McCain wanted his buddy Joe Lieberman, but he knew the party would never go for a pro-choice vice president, especially with somebody of McCain's age. And he agonized over this decision. He really wanted Lieberman, but I think he knew that it would take his outside chance at victory down to, zero. And it was those sort of decisions, and there was more than one of them, that where he sort of had to agree to, as the caller said, twist himself into a position that would accommodate the party. And that wasn't the real McCain. That it was a lose-lose thing. He was going to lose if he was himself, and he was going to lose if he tried to be somebody that he wasn't.
It's hard to imagine, isn't it? Who knows what the years will bring? But in terms of covering a campaign, Nick, this is something that will be big all of your life, don't you think?
Yes, I mean I feel extremely lucky to have been. To have done that, to have been born in the year that I was, and to do this in 2008, because it is a long, long year. A lot of airplane flights, a lot of bad hotel food and fast food, and it's great to do it in a year that has been so entertaining and so historic, as opposed to like a boring re-election or something. I remember one, Tim Russert. And reading one of the Tim Russert obituaries, it mentioned that earlier this year he would exclaim to his colleagues, can you believe they're paying us to cover this election?
Right.
It's so incredibly entertaining and riveting, really, from the early days right up until the very end. This really was one for the books.
It was. Every day there was something to talk about. And I kept thinking, maybe we're just anomalies here, but so many people, I think, follow this so closely.
Yeah. I mean, it's What I would love to see, a movie maker, or a documentarian, or somebody come back to is the 5-day period between Iowa and New Hampshire, because you know Obama's victory there is so dramatic, and his speech was a really great bit of oratory, and then the way that in the 5 days before the New Hampshire vote, Hillary just pulled herself up and almost single-handedly won that thing, and then launched the Democratic contest into this long marathon. It is so, so dramatic in such a compact period of time, and it seemed like every hour there was something crazy going on. It was really, as tiring as it was really a privilege to cover this.
I would imagine. Thank you, Nick, so much for the reporting and for joining us.
Thanks
on this last day of the year. Thanks. Our guest, Nick Summers, he is a Newsweek reporter, covered the Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and Sarah Palin campaigns, and it was part of a 7-part series and will be a book, what did he say, January 13th or 12th. It will be released as a book behind the scenes from day one. The reporters granted a whole year of access to the campaigns with a condition that their findings would not be given to us until after the election. Well, that was interesting, wasn't it? Thanks very much for listening, everybody. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing this hour, and thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our studios, new studios in Milwaukee. We'll return following the news on the Ideas Net.